We're down to, C under three, which is the conquest of Canaan. Joshua 5:13-12:23. And one under that is the conquest of Jericho in Joshua chapter 6. I'm sure you're all familiar with the story of the taking of Jericho. It was certainly a very unusual and miraculous way in which the Lord gave the city to Israel. I think the significance of the way in which Israel took Jericho is that this is the first city in the land of Canaan that the Israelites take, and I think the way in which that was done was intended by the Lord to give a clear example to them that they would receive the land as a gift from His hand, and that ultimately the land belonged to the Lord, not to Israel. You notice in chapter 6, in the second verse, the Lord says, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its kings and its fighting men." The taking of Jericho was not the result of military strategy. It was not the result of overpowering force or a long siege. But the city was given into the hands of the Israelites by God when the Israelites obeyed what might have seemed to be rather senseless and odd instructions. You notice in verse 3, they are told, "March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horn in front of the ark, and the 7th day march around the city 7 times, with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast in the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the people will go up every night straight in." So you march around this city one time for 6 days. Then you, on the 7th day, you march around it 7 times and blow the trumpet and shout, and the wall of the city is going to fall. But that's exactly what happens. Look at verse 20. "When the trumpet sounded, the people shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the people gave a loud shout, the wall collapsed. So every man charged straight in. They took the city." But what you find is that the people are told that the city, and I think this is equally the case for the rest of the land, is to be possessed only to be devoted to the glory of God. And you find that explained in verses 17 through 19. We'll get into a translation issue here, and the translation issue centers around the Hebrew word harem. You may be familiar with it. But you notice in verse 17, the city and all that is in it are to be, NIV says, devoted. That's harem. To the Lord. only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house will be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things. That's the same word. So that you will not bring about your own destruction. Own destruction is the same word. By taking any of them, any of Kerem, if the word occurs again. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel, Kerem, liable to destruction and bring trouble on. All the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord and must go into his treasury. So, that word Kerem occurs five times in those three verses. The basic idea of Kerem is to set something apart from personal use to be devoted to the Lord. And that can be done in two ways. Either by being destroyed, or by being put into the treasury of the Lord. So in this case, the inhabitants, the cattle, were to be killed and destroyed. The gold and the silver were to be put in the treasury of the Lord. And then an additional commandment is given later, the end of the chapter, where we read Joshua pronounced this solemn oath: cursed before the Lord is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city Jericho at the cost of his firstborn son, will he lay its foundations, at the cost of his youngest, will he set up its gates. I'm going to make some comments on that, but I missed in talking about Kerem referring you to your citations, page 52. Let's go back to that for a minute, just to elaborate a little bit further on it. Page 52 of your citations, there's two paragraphs from Francis Schaeffer's book, Joshua and the Flow of Biblical History. And he says, the city shall be accursed, quoting from Joshua 6:17. This NIV says, the city and all that are in it are to be devoted to the Lord. See, that's that Kerem word again. You say devoted to the Lord or accursed. The translations differ, but that's part of the difficulty of translating the word Kerem. Schaeffer says, accursed represents only a part of what this word means. The Hebrew word means both accursed or devoted. That is given to God. Here it clearly means the latter. The city shall be devoted, which is the way the NIV translates it, even it and all that are therein to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot shall wear, she and all that are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that were sent. In this way, Joshua gave the command for her protection. Joshua's commands to the people make clear the city was devoted. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the devoted thing, lest when you have devoted it, you take of the devoted thing, so you would make the camp of Israel accursed and troubled. But all the silver and gold vessels, bronze and iron, are holy under Jehovah. They shall come into the treasury of Jehovah. And then here's Schaeffer's comment. The city of Jericho was a sign of the first fruits. In all things, the first fruits belong to God. Jericho was the first fruits of the land. Therefore, everything in it was devoted to God. So that additional comment on the devoted thing. But then to get back to that curse at the end of the chapter that Jericho places on anyone who rebuilds this ruined city now of Jericho. We find that the city was not rebuilt for a long period of time. But in 1 Kings 16:34, in the time of Ahab, it was rebuilt. And in 16:34, let me back up and start at verse 30. 1 Kings 16:30. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him, who not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, began to serve Baal and worship him. And then it lists some of his evil acts. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole, did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him. And then as almost the climax of his evil acts, we read in verse 34, in Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Biram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Siguth, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. And that's a reference back to what Joshua said in chapter 6, verse 26. Anybody who rebuilt it? He'll lay the foundations at the cost of his firstborn son and set up the gates at the cost of his youngest son. Ahab reigned from 874 to 852. So you're in the 800s. Time of the conquest, you know, you go back to the early, late days. The Exodus discussion. Are you in the 1400s or the 1200s? If you're in the 1200s, that's a 400-year period of time. The late Roman. If you're in the early Roman, where I'm inclined to think of this, it's 600 years. That city was not rebuilt. And you might say, why did the Lord place that curse on anyone who would rebuild the city of Jericho? That's never explained in the biblical text. So any explanation you give is something that you infer. But it seems to me what the Lord intended here was for those ruined walls of the city of Jericho to remain as ruined walls in perpetuity in order to be a monument to the fact that Israel received the land by God's grace. They marched around that town and the walls fell down. Remember, the Lord had told Joshua to get those 12 stones as a memorial to the way in which he delivered them across the Jordan River by drying the water up. Well, it seems to me that here's another memorial. The ruins of the walls of Jericho as a reminder that when Israel comes into the land of Canaan, they are receiving that land as a gift from God. It's not their military might that is going to gain them the land of Canaan. So he wanted those walls as a perpetual testimony to the fact that this is my land. I am giving it to you. He didn't want the walls rebuilt, the gates rebuilt. Ahab, I think, as a ruler who turned away from the Lord, was not a true covenantal king. He was not a king who found his security by following the Lord and walking in obedience to the Lord and claiming the Lord's promise for protection of the nation. He did not feel that this open city, that is a city without walls, on the south eastern frontier of the northern kingdom, he didn't feel that was a strength, but rather a liability. And we know from some extra biblical information that at that time Ahab was threatened by Mesha, king of Moab. And Mesha took a city called Medeba, which was right across the Jordan from the city of Jericho. And it seems that Ahab felt a liability on that southeastern frontier of the northern kingdom and decided, I need to refortify that city in order to keep security for the northern kingdom. But he did so at the cost of the cost of his firstborn son as well as his youngest son. So those comments about the taking of the city of Jericho, I want to make a few comments about archaeological findings that relate to this chapter. We discussed this to some extent when we talked about the date for the Exodus, because Jericho comes into that discussion because Garstang said the walls of Jericho fell around 1400, so it became an argument for the early date for the Exodus. The mound of Jericho is a very well-defined mound. There's no question about site identification. If you go east from Jerusalem down the Jordan Valley, Jericho is to this day a very visible site. It's about 10 miles northwest of the mouth of the Jordan at the Dead Sea. You can picture the map where the Jordan River flows in to the Dead Sea. Right about 10 miles northwest of that is this mound. At about a mile to the west of the site of Jericho, there's a ridge of about 1,500 feet high that goes up into the highlands, the central part of the land of Canaan. And that ridge is cut by gorges that give access into the center of the land of Canaan. Jericho is of strategic significance because it guards the entrance into those passes that lead up into the central highlands. There was a good water source there. There was a strategic location recognized very early of enormous significance. Excavations were begun on the mound in the early 1900s by the Germans under a man named Ernst Sellin, S-E-L-L-I-N. And he worked on the mound for several years, 1907 to 1909. In the 1930s, an Englishman, John Garstang, worked further on the mound. And then in the 1950s, Kathleen Kenyon, also English, with further excavation on Jericho. And what the Germans and Garstang and Kenyon all found out was that this site had a very long history. The oldest town dates to about 9,000 BC in the Neolithic Stone Age. I might say, my wife and I visited Jericho some years ago. We drove down from Jerusalem on the road. We get to the outskirts of the modern town of Bethlehem, the ancient sites off to the side of the modern site. There's a sign when you come into Jericho that says, the oldest town on earth. And that may be an exaggeration, but not much of it. I mean, a site that has a history going back to 9,000 BC, was pretty much accepted. But the excavation showed that in the early Bronze Age, we go back to those archaeological periods, in the early Bronze Age, 3,000 to 2,000, it was a very important walled city. Just to give you an idea of the setting, that parallels the time of the Pyramid Age in Egypt. And if we get down to the latter part of the early Bronze Age, this is the same as Ur of the Chaldees, where third dynasty of Earth, where Abraham was in southern Mesopotamia. So, it was an important city at that time. It was destroyed between 2300 and 2000. We don't know who exactly was the agent of that destruction. But I might say here that the walls of that period of time were the ones that Garstang initially thought were the time of Joshua, who was later revived. In the Middle Bronze Age, 2000 to 1500, you again get a well-built city, strong walls. It grew to the greatest size it ever attained. You're now in the patriarchal period from 2000 to 1500. As far as what's going on in the land of Canaan. At the end of the Middle Bronze, it again was violently destroyed. And again, you wonder who was the agent of the destruction. We don't know. Some people used to speculate that it was the Hyksos. The Hyksos were foreign rulers of Egypt for a period of time. And they were driven out of Egypt about 1750. No, they were driven out about 1570, or turned it around. They ruled in Egypt from about 1750 down to 1570. But about 1570, they're driven out of Egypt. Where did they go? Did they come up into the land of Canaan? Possibly. Did they attack Jericho? No, it's possible. But we're not certain. But again, it was destroyed at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. In the Late Bronze Age, which is the period that interests us with respect to the story of the Book of Joshua, the city was again occupied. However, from what the archaeologists tell us, there's very little left on the mound from that period of time. Garstang had argued that the city had been destroyed at about 1400 in that Late Bronze Age. Kathleen Kenyon contested that. She spoke of, in her words, a tremendous denudation of the upper strata of the mound of this period of time. It seems that a lot of this level was eroded away during that 400 to 600 year period, when the city was largely uninhabited after it had fallen to Joshua, between Joshua and Ahab. It's, for all intents and purposes, an uninhabited site. If you look at your citations, page 51, James Kelso, in Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible article on Jericho, says, in 1952, Kathleen Kenyon began her work on the mound. After 5 years of her work, the archaeological picture is clearer, and the following conclusions now seem valid. Most of the mound is 16th century BC or earlier. Indeed, the major depth of the mound is actually Neolithic. In other words, most of the mound belongs to prehistoric times, and the last big city was something like 300 years earlier than Moses. Unfortunately, she has found that the small amount of the upper levels which had escaped destruction by wind and rain were those areas already worked by the Germans in Garstang. Jericho was built of mud brick, and this quickly disintegrated, is quickly disintegrated by both wind and rain. The same winds which furnished the force draft for Solomon's smelters of Ezion Geber had already blasted away at the mud bricks of Jericho. One year, the English excavations here were flooded by heavy rains. Even in the Neolithic era, Miss Kenyon found stream channels and cutting the parts of the mound. Therefore, it seems unlikely that anything new can be learned of 13th century Jericho from the mound itself, although nearby tombs may prove very helpful in the future. Then notice this last sentence. One of the major tragedies of Palestinian archaeology is that the Germans excavated Jericho when archaeology was still an infant science. The Germans came in there in the early 1900s before methods had been developed for excavation and disturbed this area of the mound. Well, that information is law. Go down to the next paragraph from Kahneman, on page 51 of the Riverside version. She says, occupation of the site started in the Mesolithic, about 9,000. There was a continuous development from that stage into a town of the pre-pottery Neolithic period, about 8,000, successfully occupied by two different groups of people. Thereafter, there was a very much lesser occupation by Neolithic people with pottery. Not yet clear whether there was a gap before these arrived. So from that time, late in the fourth millennium, there was continuous occupation until the town was destroyed. Notice their date to it. At about 1580, it was probably reoccupied about 1400. By the town of this period, almost nothing remains. Now, we talked about this when we talked about Jericho earlier. If you take John Benson's thesis in his book, Redating the Exodus in a Context, where he moves the dating of archaeological periods, and particularly the end of that Middle Bronze Age, down into the next century, into the 1400s, that would move that 1580 destruction level down, say, to 1400. And then you're pretty close to the early date for the Exodus based on the 1561, 1436 kind of reads. So that debate, as I mentioned before, is an ongoing thing. If Kenyon's correct about that 1580 group being a destruction level, and then you link her 1580 date with Benson's revision of the dates of archaeological periods, it fits with an earlier date. However, as I mentioned earlier, Brian G. Wood more recently has come into the picture, and I gave you that handout on Jericho of a summary of his article in VAR, which is in your bibliography, where he argues, going back into Kenyon's own excavation reports, that there's good evidence that the city was destroyed in the 1400s, and that her dating is wrong there. So the debate goes on. Let me just give you one other quotation here. Look at page 53. No, I'm going to hold this. I can read it at this point. It applies to another thing that we're coming to in a minute. But look at the middle of page 53. Biblical Exodus redating fatally flawed in VAR 13.6.1987. Bruce Halperin is here arguing against Benson's redating of the Middle Bronze Age, moving that date down. He says, the biblical account of the conquest was written late in the 7th century B.C., in other words, in the 600s, very late, and fails to link the conquest to any event that external sources permit us to date. So by taking elementary precautions against skepticism about the biblical text, by pressing one's eyelids down tightly on the cheekbone, one can pretend that the book of Joshua is the unvarnished, untarnished truth, and that it all occurred in the 15th century B.C. Israel conquered Canaan in a single decisive campaign. What B&L, now B&L was Benson and Livingston. David Livingston is someone who was bought into Benson's redating of the archaeological period. So he says, what B&L have done is to accord unquestioning credulity to their own highly idiosyncratic reading of the biblical conquest accounts. B&L's smorgasbord approach is attractive because it masquerades as a defense of the Bible, but it is not. B&L dismiss as much biblical evidence in the end as they embrace picking and choosing. Their textually arbitrary, historically unconvincing, archaeologically improbable hypothesis hides its warts behind a veneer of benevolent piety. Piety has its place, no doubt, but it also has its price. And the going price for B&L's piety is about 200 years of Israelite history. That's this redating thing. Now, I read you that paragraph to just show you some of the kind of almost vitriolic language that is used against people that attempt to defend the reliability of the conquest stories and the conquest of Jericho. Okay. Well, those comments on Jericho. Two is the attack on I. Some call it AI. But that's Joshua 7 and 8. In the first five verses of chapter 7, you read that Joshua, verse 2, sent men from Jericho to Ai and told them, go up and spy out the region. And when they returned, they said, not all the people have to go up against Ai, send 2,000 or 3,000. There are only a few men there. Verse 4, so about 3,000 men went up. But they were routed by the men of Ai, who killed about 36 of them. They chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarry, struck them down on the slopes. This, the hearts of the people melted, became like water. So they sent that small force up there, but they didn't think it was a significant opposition, and they're defeated. And Joshua wonders why. We read in verse 6, Joshua tore his clothes, fell face down to the ground. Elders of Israel did the same. Joshua said, verse 7, ah, sovereign Lord, why did you ever bring this people across the Jordan to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been content to stay on the other side of the Jordan. After, the remarkable crossing. Oh, Lord, what can I say now that Israel's been routed by its enemies? The Canaanites and the other people of the country will hear about this. They will surround us and wipe out our name from the earth. Then what will you do for your own great name? And the Lord's response is, stand up, why are you down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of Harem, the devoted things. They have stolen, they have lied, they have put them in their own possessions. That is why the Israelites cannot stand against their enemies. They turn their backs and run because they've been made liable to destruction. That's Keteremah, liable to destruction. I will not be with you anymore unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction. So they find out that this man Achan had taken from the things that were to be devoted from the Lord that he was explicitly commanded that they not do. And you read down verse 20, Achan says, I've sinned against the Lord. This is what I've done. When I sold the plunder of beautiful gold from Babylon with 200 shekels of silver, a wedge of gold, weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. So he and his family are taken. They are stoned. And you read in verse 26, over Achan, they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. Here's another memorial. This time a reminder of divine judgment on sin. Another reminder of the rocks crossing the river. The fallen walls of Jericho. God's grace. Here's a reminder of what happens when you disobey God. So after that, in chapter 8, a new force is taken up, or sent up to Ai. And this time, they are successful. And you read in verse 19b, they entered the city, captured it, set it on fire. The man of Idle Pack saw the smoke of the city rising against the sky. I won't go into all the strategy in order to do that. But they take the city, and you read in verse 25, 12,000 men and women fell that day, all the people alive. But Joshua did not draw back the hand that held out his javelin until he had destroyed all of the land. And then verse 28, he burned up and made it a permanent heap of ruins. And he hung the king of Ai on the tree. Now, this is a case where there's a lot of discussion, again, about the way in which archaeological research relates to the biblical text. In the 1930s, there was a mound that is currently known as Et Tel that was thought to be the site of Ai, and it was excavated. And those that worked on that mound tell us that the city was destroyed at about 2200 BC and was not occupied again except for a very small Iron One settlement at about 1200 to 1050. So if this site was not occupied from 2200 down to 1200, that raises problems for correlating those archaeological findings with what we're told in Joshua 7 and 8. And that question has been around for second half of the 20th century and continues to this day. A discussion of it continues. There have been various proposals to try to harmonize, you might say, archaeological findings with the biblical prescription. There was a French Old Testament scholar by the name of Vincent, last name Vincent, V-I-N-C-U-N-T, who suggested that Et Tel, or Ai, was a military outpost of battle, and that the conquest of Ai was really not the conquest of a city, but the overrunning of a military outpost of battle, and that if it was simply a military outpost of battle, you wouldn't expect much evidence left for occupation of the site. Well, that's an interesting suggestion. Part of this is because Joshua doesn't say anything about taking the battle. Was I a military outpost of Bethel? I don't think you can harmonize that with the text. If you go to chapter 12, where you have that list of kings taken, you read in verse 9, the king of Ai near Bethel won, one king. You go down to verse 16, the king of Bethel won. Well, there was a king of Ai, there was a king of Bethel. Doesn't sound like Ai was a military outpost of Bethel. Another suggestion, you'll find in your citations page 52, this is a paragraph from Finnegan's Light from the Ancient Past. And he's talking about this problem of harmonizing archaeological data with the biblical text. And he says the most probable explanation of the difficulty at this point lies in a confusion between Ai and Bethel. The site of the latter city, that is Bethel, is less than 1.5 miles distant from Ai and is known as Betin. That is the site. Modern site identification, Betin was thought to be Bethel. Excavations were conducted here by joint expeditions, American School of Oriental Research, Pittsburgh Xenia Theological Seminary, under William Hawthorne Albright, and James Kelso, and followed. Bethel was found to have been occupied first after the destruction of the early Bronze Age city of Iandale. It existed as a well-built town in the middle and late Bronze Ages. Sometime in the 13th century, the city was consumed by a tremendous conflagration that left behind a solid mass of burned brick, ashes, charred debris. There can be little doubt that this destruction represents the conquest of the city by the children of Israel. That's a fact. Now, the next paragraph, he says, it may be noted that in the book of Joshua, no account is given of the capture of Bethel. While on the other hand, in the probably older account of Judges, the taking of Bethel by the house of Joseph is narrated, but nothing is said of Ai. Therefore, it may be supposed, and this is Albright's view and a number of others, that at a later date, the tradition of the sack of Bethel was attached erroneously, but naturally, to the nearby impressive ruins of Ai. In other words, what do we do with this seeming inconsistency between archaeological findings on Bethel and the biblical account of the taking of Ai? Well, whoever wrote this history got the story of the destruction of Bethel confused with the story of the destruction of Ai. And what you're really reading in 7 and 8 is about Bethel, not about it. Of course, that means the biblical text is not reliable. If you look at page 53 of your citations, both three at the top of the page and Kitchen at the bottom of the page discuss this problem. And I think they go in a direction that's the most sensible one to go. Free says, a recent solution has been offered in the suggestion of Jay Simons that Bethel is not to be identified with Bethel Ai. In other words, this site identification is the problem. It's the wrong site identification. Bethel is not Ai. So any excavation done at Bethel is not telling you anything about Ai. He offers, that is Jay Simons, four objections to this identification. One, Bethel is not particularly near Beitim Bethel, whereas Joshua 12:9 indicates that Ai is beside Bethel. Two, Bethel is a large site, where Joshua 3 describes the people as few. Three, Bethel was not a ruin in the post-conquest period, whereas Joshua indicates Ai was. And four, there's no broad valley to the north of Bethel, whereas Joshua 8:11 indicates the existence of the valley there. So, Free is arguing, problem here is site identification. If Bethel is not to be identified with Ai, then the indication that Bethel was not in existence in 1400 BC has no bearing on the biblical indication concerning Ai. Or if Pere Vincent's suggestion that Ai was a fortress would leave little or nothing remains is correct, again, the biblical narrative offers no difficulty. But it does offer difficulty with the king of Ai and the king of Bethel. So he says, in view of such possible solutions, it's inadvisable to insist the Bible must be wrong. K. A. Kitchen is very similar at the bottom of the page. He says, excavations at Bethel failed to produce any proper evidence of occupation there after the early Bronze Age, apart from a small Israelite settlement, 1200 to 1050. The site assertion sometimes made the contrary. This situation suggests that Bethel is not Ai, but another ancient site, perhaps Beth Avon, and that Ai must be looked for somewhere else in the area, not on Bethel. I might say this kind of site identification is a pretty serious problem. There are mounds all through the land of Canaan, and there are no signposts that are saying this was this or that ancient city. You have, you know, these mounds, and you dig into them, there's a lot of rubble. And you read about place names in the Bible. How do you connect a Bible place name with some mound? It's not an easy business. Albright, way back in the 20s and 30s, rode around Canaan on the donkey and made site identifiers. So, well, this is this site, this is that site, this site. And many times he had good reason to make them, but he many cases, they're wrong side of that. Kitchen says, when mounds and literary records fail to agree in other cases, topographers and archaeologists do not panic, but simply use their common sense. Recognize they were probably mistaken in their identification and proceed to search elsewhere in the region. The problem of I should be regarded in exactly the same way. Jericho and I are lessons in negative evidence. Notice that. The absence of the expected body of remains of Late Bronze Age date does not automatically imply the biblical narratives or inventions or archaeological data. Kitchen's dictum is absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's an interesting way to put it. But just because you don't have the evidence you might wish to have doesn't mean the biblical text or some other text was necessarily wrong. The circumstantial realism of the topographical allusions and of Joshua's leadership suggest otherwise, as does the analogy of archaeological failure to produce remains tallying with other and indisputably original ancient Oriental written documents. Now, since Kitchen and Free made those comments about site identification, a man named David Livingston began investigating this, and you'll find some entries in your bibliography under this heading. See what page that is. Page 12. You notice in the middle of the page there of your bibliography, Livingston wrote an article in the Westminster Theological Journal in 1970 entitled "The Location of Biblical Bethel and I Reconsidered." And then another article a year later, "Traditional Site of Bethel Question." And another article in 1994, "Further Considerations on the Location of Bethel at Elbira." What Livingston does in those articles is suggest that we need new site identification, not just for I, but also for Bethel. And the traditional view was that Bethel was Beitin and I was at Tep. And Livingston makes a rather detailed case with lots of kinds of arguments and evidence that I won't get into, that we should relocate both of those to different sites, and that Bethel is perhaps a site called Bera instead of Beitin, and that I is either Kirbet Nisa or Kirbet El Masatir. You look at a map, you can see that Beitin is here, Bera is here. So the old site of Bethel was there, the new site here. Etel, the old site of I, the new site either Kirbet El Makatir or Kirbet Nisa. You see, those sites are all in pretty close proximity to each other. The question is, which mound is which site? From the excavations, I'll just make a couple quick remarks. From the excavations up to this point that Livingston has done at Kirbet Nisa, as I, he has found that occupation of that site ceased at about the time of the transition from the Middle Bronze to the Late Bronze Age. In other words, you're there at that 1500 period. And again, if you lower that 1500 period, as Brinson argues, it would fit. If you don't, well then it might not fit. Bryant Wood, who wrote that article about Jericho, has been excavating in recent years at that other site, at the Pier Bethel Matatia. And that has come up with some very interesting findings. He found that Matatia was a fortified site dating to the time of Joshua in the 1400s. And it's the only fortified site in that Late Bronze Age. Late Bronze Age is 1500 to 1200. It's the only fortified site of the Late Bronze Age between Jerusalem and Shechem that so far has been discovered. Now Shechem is way to the north. So it was a significant site. He is continuing to excavate there, and it'll be interesting to see what he comes up with. But it certainly is a possibility. And if that does prove to turn out to have evidence that maybe this is I, it could solve this problem. And on the other issue of changing the traditional location of Bethel from Beitin to Bera. The interesting thing at Beitin is, in excavations done there, they've never found evidence for the high place that was constructed, you remember, by Jeroboam the First after the division of the kingdom. He put an altar at Bethel and one up at Dan. And they've never found evidence of that. No excavations have been done at Bera. So there's a site that also may prove interesting in the future if it could ever be excavated. The problem is political. Bera is a Palestinian town on the West Bank. The highest point of the town, which would presumably be a place to look for Jeroboam's high place, is the site of the house of the mayor of the town, who is Palestinian. All that's involved in that. So I don't think there's going to be any excavations in the near future at Bera. But this question of I and how you relate the archaeological findings to the biblical account of Joshua's taking of I is something that is an ongoing question. Boy, that ran over time.